on this episode of The Jason Wright Show.
Do you want to hear a secret that upset some people about that shoe? You know why it's called the HFS? So we say it could stand for a lot of things. It could stand for happy face shoe, because that's what people get when they put it on. It could stand for highly flexible sole, because it has one. It could stand for happy feet shoe, because your feet feel as good at the end of the day as they did at the beginning. What it actually stands for is when we gave it to our wear testers originally, every one of them came back and said, "Holy..."
All right, Steven, welcome to the Jason Wright Show. Thank you so much for being here.
Pleasure.
I am so excited. All right, I was waiting till I started recording because this will be on YouTube, but I want to show you. I am a diehard, baby. Check this out. So the most recent purchase, got my Melbourne, Chelsea there. Yeah. So for the listener who can't see this, if you go on YouTube, you can see my Melbourne Chelsea boot. This thing is like, if you like Chelsea boots, but you want to wear something that you can literally take off running in, there you go.
I got to interrupt. It's so funny.
Go for it.
We've had people who've done everything you can think of and nothing that you imagine they should in every shoe we make. So like the first shoe we made was a casual canvas shoe. Within a week, you know, we're getting videos from people. Hey, look, I'm at the top of Kilimanjaro. It's like, it's not a hiking. Whatever. Knock yourself out.
Yeah, I believe it.
Yeah, we've had people run marathons in our hiking boots because they just couldn't find the size they wanted in the running shoe they wanted. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's been outrageous to see.
Well, I'm not surprised. I'm one of those guys. And like the next, the Prio, which I freaking love. This one, I'll be honest with you, this one's a little beefy for me, which by the way, to the listener, if you've never owned a pair of Zeros, beefy Zeros, it's an oxymoron. But then I swear, like putting baby smiles and unicorn breath on my feet is the HFS. Oh my God. They're just so amazing.
Do you want to hear a secret that upset some people about that shoe?
Absolutely.
You know why it's called the HFS?
No.
So we say it could stand for a lot of things. It could stand for happy face shoe, because that's what people get when they put it on. It could stand for highly flexible sole, because it has one. It could stand for happy feet shoe, because your feet feel as good at the end of the day as they did at the beginning. What it actually stands for is when we gave it to our wear testers originally, every one of them came back and said, "Holy something."
That's awesome.
That's what we call it.
Well, I love it. I love it. And so just so the listener knows, I asked Steven to come on the show because one, he's into health and wellness. He's an entrepreneur. There's you check so many boxes on what I try to bring this audience. But more than anything, man, I know the audience can hear it in my voice. If they're watching, they can see it that I'm geeking out because you are the CEO of one of my favorite companies. With all that, I'm going to chill out for a minute and let's get down to it. Tell me a little bit about your background. Take it back as far as you want leading up to this whole Zero Shoes, journey that you've been on. I know you are a sprinter. Just start where you think makes sense, Steven.
Okay. So in the beginning, everything was a singularity. Okay. And then it expanded dramatically. If I don't go back that far, when a mommy meets a daddy, they get together. So what happened for me is I got back into sprinting 14 years ago when I was 45, was getting injured pretty much constantly. And a friend of mine who's a world champion cross country runner said, "Why don't you try running barefoot and see what you learn?" Now, I'm not telling people to run barefoot. I'm just telling you my story. We'll talk about the difference in a minute. But by doing that, by getting out of my traditional shoes, which were recommended by other runners and, of course, people at running shoe stores, like this is what everyone wears. So this is what you should wear, padded motion control or sport, you know, something that looked basically like this with a big thick heel and flared sole and pointy toes, et cetera. I got out of those shoes. Now, again, I'm a sprinter. So the longest I had ever run, not of my own volition, was about a mile, mile and a half. Did not like one moment of it. Yeah, maybe the first 20 seconds, it's okay. But after that, hated it. And anyway, I was so entranced by the feeling of being in my bare feet. We were running on roads and trails and grass and streets and dirt and over wooden bridges. I mean, you name it. And I just kept experimenting with my gait because I was so fascinated. What happens if I move my legs faster but don't run faster, or move them slower but don't run slower, or run faster but keep my cadence the same, or land on different parts of my foot? I mean, I was just so curious because it was so interesting. I was getting so much feedback from the ground, or feedback, if you will, if you can handle a horrible pun. And at the end of this, someone had a GPS watch on. I said, how far was that? And she goes, that's a little over 5K. And it's like, I'm sorry, what? I mean, I was dumbstruck. Wow. And I could have kept going. Just we decided to stop. And that was amazing to me. I wanted that natural movement experience as much as I could have it without having to argue about people if I was trying to get into a restaurant barefoot, which, by the way, totally legal. I was in Costco the other day. I'm in the line at the pharmacy and I was wearing our shoes. And when I'm wearing shoes, they never are the same color on each foot. I wear different colors on each foot just to get attention. And there's a guy standing behind me and he says, hey, your shoes don't match. And the pharmacist said, he's wearing shoes.
That's awesome.
I'm not. But I wanted that natural movement experience to lock in the form change that I naturally adopted when I was running barefoot, because doing it wrong feels bad. Doing it right feels good.
Right.
And so I started making sandals based on a 10,000-year-old design idea. And people kept asking me for more. It was like, you know, they tell two friends and they tell two friends. And then a guy named Michael Sandler was writing a book called Barefoot Running. And he said, if you treated this goofy little sandal-making hobby like a business and had a website, I'd put you in my book. So I rush home. I pitch this incredible opportunity to my wife, who assures me I have my head firmly up my butt, and it's a horrible idea that won't make any money, real waste of time. And I said, yeah, you're right, I won't do it. And then after she went to bed, I built a website. So that's how it all began. And then we've been ridiculously lucky and hardworking for the last 11 and a half years, but the luck factor is through the roof with everything we've done. And now we have, you know, a complete line of boots, shoes, and sandals that people use for everything from taking a walk to running ultra marathons. And we've sold product to, like, you know, 100 countries. It's outrageous.
It's so cool to watch the every time a new product comes online, I get excited. Like, and I could easily start to collect zero shoes. I mean, it's that pathetic for me. Like, I want the Denver so bad. I'm like, I want a pair of black Denvers so bad. I've been holding off because I've probably worn my Melbournes maybe, you know, 10 times. You know, I need to at least let them get kind of broken, although zeros don't really need broken in. But anyway, so I have a fetish.
But what you're pointing to is two things. One is that once you let your body do what it's designed to do, because that's all we're talking about. Everything, you know, we do is about getting out of the way to let your feet do their job so the rest of your body can do its job. When your feet can't do their job, all the function they're trying to do, which is about balance and mobility and agility, if they can't do that, that function tries to move unsuccessfully up into your ankle, your knee, your hip, and your back. So we want your feet to do their job so your body can do its job. So that's part one. Part two is the way our product line has expanded is from people just asking us for things. I love your sandals, but I need something for cold weather or the office. I love the running shoe, but I need something for trail running. I need, you know, it's winter. I need like a winter snow boot. I mean, most of what we've done has just been from listening to our customers.
Howdy, folks. Real quick interruption. Sorry. You didn't see that coming, did you? Listen, first of all, thank you for listening to The Jason Wright Show. I cannot begin to describe how grateful I am. Second, will you do me a favor? If you like the show, if you're here every week, please go out to iTunes and leave me a 5-star rating. This is how we climb in the rankings. This is how I continue to bring you incredible guests free of charge, like Steven Sashin, the founder and CEO of Zero Shoes. And by the way, if you don't want to have athletic shoes that suck any longer and you want to have happy feet, if you want to wrap your feet in baby smiles and have them tickled by unicorn horns, then go out to jasonrightnow.com/happyfeet and make your feet happy by ordering a pair of Zero Shoes today. You will be glad you did. Now, with that, back to our regularly scheduled program. Enjoy the show.
Who tell us what they want next. And so the number of people who own 10, 15, 20 pairs of our shoes is crazy high. And it's part because, again, once you feel that natural experience, you can't go back to something that elevates your heel and messes with your posture, that squeezes your toes together, that weighs too much, that gives you support that you don't need. My wife describes it best as after she was wearing the sandals that I made for her out of that original batch, where she kind of patted me on the head like, thanks, honey, well, what the hell are these?
Right.
And then she wore them for a couple of weeks as an experiment. And then she put on her regular, quote, healthy sandals. And just the phenomenon of not being able to feel and interact with the ground, she went, oh, no, this is totally wrong. And she just threw them away. Which I was very upset by, because I sold mine on eBay and made a few bucks.
Always the entrepreneur. Well, listen, that's it's interesting you bring that up. And there's two, but I want to talk a little bit more about the shoe. Then I want to get into two stories. One, you're getting back into sprinting because it's my podcast. I'm selfish and I'm thinking about doing that. It blew my mind whenever I went back and watched your Shark Tank reel and I saw that you had got into master sprinting. I was like, oh my God. There's someone I can actually ask about this. So I want to touch on that. But one of the things I want to tell you that as a user, if you will, a customer, so the first time you put on a pair of Zero shoes, it feels weird. If you've never, like all my running shoes, big, thick, cushy, you know, Brooks or whatever, fill in the blank. And so all of a sudden, it's like anything else. You start to use muscles. This is the layperson's description of my experience. I start to use muscles that I'm like, I don't know if I like these or not. I'm almost feeling too much. Now, fast forward now, Stephen, I put on a pair, especially the HFS, especially those are the ones that whenever I'm training, I have the most interaction with the ground. And man, it is like a massage for my foot. I wish I could remember, and this is not an overstatement. I can't remember who the lady was that wrote the book about kind of decluttering. And she said, there you go. Remember, her deal is if it doesn't make you feel good, if you don't feel happy when you hold it or whatever, get rid of it. Your shoe, and not overstating, not false flattery, your shoe is one of those things that it's like, these just, when I put them on, they make me happy, man. I'm an aspiring minimalist, and it is known as, you know, it's one of the things it's called, is the minimalist running shoe.
Right.
And it's one of those things, I'm not getting rid of my Zeros. I'm just not. They're just that fantastic. So,
well, you know, like the sparking joy thing and the minimalist thing, I pitched a book to a bunch of publishers and they were actually really interested, and I'll give the idea away because somebody might do it and save me the effort, called Enough. That is a variation, let's say, of Marie Kondo's thing. I did this 15, 16 years ago, but the gist is that when you understand what enough means, it doesn't mean you have too little. It doesn't mean you have too much. It means you have enough, the right amount for what you're doing, for how you're living. And I know people who live with next to nothing. There's a guy named Rob Greenfield. He has like 110 possessions, two of them are Zero shoes.
Yeah.
And there's people who have, you know, huge whatever they have. And given their lifestyle, you know, there's people that have this 12, I was in their house, it's 12,000 square feet. It's insane. Except they're very socially active and they have lots of events where they're getting people together to engender, you know, some new movement. And for them, that's what they need. You know, that's the world they're living in. But they also just have enough. And interestingly, with their enough, they designed their house, every square inch of their house was custom made based on them figuring out what they wanted. Back into Marie Kondo talking about sparking joy, you know, it's like there's nothing that they can interact with in their house that they don't love because they picked it out. And that's an amazing way to live, whether you have very little or a whole lot. But anyway, backing up to your original comment about getting used to using muscles that you haven't used in a while. So research from a woman named Christina Protopapas and a couple other people involved in that took healthy athletes and put arch support in their shoes. And within 12 weeks, they had lost up to 17% of the muscle mass in their feet.
Really?
That ain't good.
Yeah.
So if you've been wearing traditional footwear for a while, your feet have gotten weaker. Your ankles have probably gotten weaker. So when you put on something that lets your feet bend and move and flex naturally, you will, in fact, be using muscles you haven't used in a while. And in fact, research from Dr. Sarah Ridge shows that just walking in minimalist footwear, she didn't do the study with ours because we didn't have shoes for her then, but shoes that aren't even as flexible and lightweight and minimalist as ours, walking in minimalist footwear strengthens your feet as much as doing an actual foot exercise program. So those are two things that are important. In a related note, you've got 200,000 nerve endings in the soles of your feet. Clearly, that's for a reason. It's more than anywhere but your fingertips and your lips. So it's telling your brain what you're stepping on or in, so your brain knows how to move your body efficiently and effectively. If you have been making your feet numb by not letting them feel the ground, by having all that padding in between you and the ground, then at first it can feel like overstimulation because your brain is like, yes, and it's like hypersensitive. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't, it's not that you become less sensitive or that your the skin in your feet gets thicker or anything, but over time, it's just that your brain gets used to what's normal. And because that's really, because what you're experiencing is normal. And it does feel like a foot massage when you go out, because that's exactly what you're supposed to feel. You're supposed to be feeling things enough so your body knows how to interact with the terrain that you're on.
Okay. And so now I want to get into a little bit of the entrepreneurial side of your business. All right. So watching Shark Tank, I had not seen that episode since, I guess, probably it originally aired. And one of the things that came through for me as an entrepreneur myself and having been in that position doing the pitch, the proverbial pitch, and it sucks. It's awful. For those of you who have never done it, doing a pitch sucks because that's, and but here's what I took from yours that I think it takes one to know one. So whenever the sharks were looking at your business, the thing that they could not put into their valuation was you. And it seems to me that knowing that, just watching, I mean, you look, this is what I know about you from afar. It's not like I've done some deep research. I keep this very conversational to find out, to come in curious, but here's what I've seen from afar before I even had a podcast and I was a zero customer. You obviously executed digital marketing incredibly well. That had to have been strategic. So you've been very wise in how you have marketed. Your sales channels seem to be very much direct to consumer, and that's been brilliant. But here's what I've noticed of late, Stephen, that I think is really cool. So the first place I ever saw a pair of Zero shoes was on Tony Horton's feet. I've been a P90X guy for 12 years. And then I see Peter Attia wearing them. And so now it's like all of a sudden people who, and again, I want to phrase this properly. People who are truly concerned with longevity.
Yeah.
Right. That are not just wanting to gain muscle mass, but are truly looking at the science. I see those guys and gals wearing Zeros, and that's what piqued my interest. So all of that is kind of my worldview of you and your company. Take me back prior to Shark Tank, because you were a functioning company. I think you guys had at that time, if I'm remembering correctly, you had significant sales. I mean, it was like...
I wouldn't say significant. The year prior to being on the show, I think it was about $500,000, which I know sounds like a lot, but...
Yeah. For someone, a startup shoe company, I mean, come on, considering
No. We are a startup sandal kit.
Well, there you go. Yeah, exactly. I mean, come on.
Yeah, I know. So, no, look, I'm not trying to minimize it. Just, you know, compared to where we are now, it's
really
funny. I mean, and we're still a small company in the shoe world, but yeah, we had done about $500,000 at that point. So first of all, thank you. It's all very kind of you. Secondly, I've been an internet marketer since before there was an internet. I mean, I was selling things on CompuServe and AOL and Prodigy and before that, even on bulletin boards like The Well. Well, The Well was in San Francisco. I was in the New York version called Echo. So I've been in the digital marketing world since like 1992. But I was literally one of the first guys to teach SEO back in 1993 or 94.
Now, Stephen, so, why did that happen? Because if I'm not mistaken, you're a theater major. You went to Columbia and majored in theater, right?
So no, I was a cognitive psych pre-med major at Duke, and then I got a master's in film at Columbia. And when I was getting my master's in film,
so you're not a smart guy at all. Crap. You just raised the
It depends on the domain. There are certain things and certain domains in which I'm a complete moron and others where I'm relatively smart. So what happened when I was at Columbia, I was writing screenplays.
Okay.
And the software that existed was dumb and it was getting in the way of my trying to write. And I, one day in the shower, came up with a better way of doing it. And then I invented what became the industry standard word processing software for film and television writers. That was in 1992 when it launched. And so just in learning to market that, that's how I got hip to, you know, internet marketing things.
So is that, it sounds to me like that's kind of in your DNA. If you see something that doesn't work to your liking, you're willing to go figure out how to make something that does.
Yeah. Another way of saying that is I'm a moron. So when there's a problem where I see the solution I pray that someone else solves it before me so I don't have to go through it. And if that doesn't work, then I do it. So like with my software, I went out to a trade show that was all for showbiz related things. And I interviewed the programmers from what became my competitors or the people that I put out of business, because what we did was so much better. And just to see what they were thinking and see if they had come up with a solution like mine or more elegant than mine. And they were so far off. I went, yeah, I gotta do this on my own. Same thing with Zero Shoes is the only person who was trying to do anything similar to what I was doing wasn't treating it like a business. It was too hard to get materials. It was just it was a pain. And so I knew there was a better way, and that's what inspired me to, you know, ignore my wife and build a website.
So now take me back to those early days where, I mean, truly we all have our hero's journey of some sort. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Let's go back to the time warp. We all have our hero's journey of some sort, but for the entrepreneur, and especially a story like yours, I mean, I have to believe that you have dealt with those instances like we all as entrepreneurs do, where it's like, is this worth it? Or maybe you haven't. Maybe you're wired such that you're like, no, there is no turning back. We burned the ships. Talk us through that.
Well, a little bit of both and neither. But I mean, again, we've been really lucky. The luckiest thing was the timing of when we started the business. The book Born to Run was becoming popular at that same time. The whole barefoot movement was kind of kicking off as a result. I was a good search engine guy. In the early days, for example, with the search engine marketing stuff that I did, if you did a search for any keyword that I cared about, barefoot running, barefoot sandals, Tatarmata running, you know, I mean, any of those, I had 40 of the top 50 results minimum. And that was just an era in the Google world where that was possible. It's not possible anymore.
Right.
They've changed so many things between now and then. So really lucky. Our product developer is a guy that we met socially because his dog knew another dog, and the dog started hanging out. And then the guys who were on the other end of the leash started talking to each other. And normally they don't walk the dogs, the wives did, but this started a conversation. And our friend said, hey, my friend Steve and Elena have a shoe company. And the guy says, well, I used to be the head of global product design for Crocs. And it's like, oh, let me get your number. And I'm going, why would this guy want to talk to me? So I sat on the phone number for months. Then I eventually called him. We had an amazing lunch. He goes, well, I bought your product and it changed my life. So I'd love to help. And it's like, I don't think we can afford you. He goes, I just retired. I went, you're on. So, wow. You know, the fact that that the dogs met led to one of the most important people in our company being here for the last 8 years. So we've been lucky in that sales have been growing in a significant clip since day one. We had one down year right after Shark Tank, actually, because Shark Tank just gave us this big bump. And then the next year was down a little bit. And then the year after that was, you know, twice the size. So, so that hasn't been an issue. The difficult entrepreneurial things are making stuff is hard. Making shoes is really hard. We had guys who we met maybe 7 months in who said, you know, we believe in you and Lena, my wife, who I started this with. We believe in the two of you, and we believe in what you're doing. Natural movement is the most important thing in footwear. But we've all been in the footwear world for 35 years. You know, we would start this with you, but we're so experienced that we're not stupid enough to try and start a shoe company. And we said, well, you know, the only way anything ever gets done is naivete and optimism. So away we go. The most difficult thing for us has been, in no particular order, managing the growth. Because we needed to have, which is related to managing the capital, the cash to support that growth, and finding people who believed in us enough to lend us money based on projections rather than history. Because when you're growing 50, 60, 100% a year, you know, they just don't understand. And then managing the growth internally has been tricky as well. We've been very fortunate. We have amazing people working here. But to be candid, over the last 11 and a half years, we've had a couple of people who, you know, not so hot. That one of them, at one point, I had a conversation where I said, look, I know you think you're way smarter than me and Lena. I'm not going to argue with you, but here's the amount of money you need to pay me to you so you can prove it. It's like, if you want the company, it's all yours. I don't care, but here's what it's going to cost. And he's like, no, I don't think so. Right. Or we had one person who said, well, I think I deserve some equity in the company. And Lena and I said, that's cool. We're personally guaranteeing $5 million in debt. How much of that would you like? Yep. And they went, oh, okay, never mind. So, so that's been the ever-present challenge is just managing the growth. And again, the footwear industry, making shoes is really, really hard. So every now and then, we've gotten some product where we can't sell half of it. because it was made incorrectly, even after they demonstrated in the what's called the confirmation samples that they could make it correctly. Then something changed. And so, we've never had to pivot really. Actually, I take that back. The original business model was based on our do-it-yourself sample kit. And we had the idea that we would give away free 3D scanning kiosks to stores, like shoe stores, where people would stand on the kiosk, get their 3D measurement of their foot. That would get sent to us, and we'd have some computer-controlled machine to custom make a pair of sandals for them.
Okay.
Then we found out that the kiosks were $20,000 each, and that we couldn't find the technology to do the custom-made thing in a way that would have worked. And so, but that was at the exact same time that our customers were saying, hey, I love the DIY thing, but I'd rather have something ready to wear. And the same time that Dennis, our product guy, came on board, and between the two of us, we figured out a way to do ready to wear. So it wasn't so much a pivot out of necessity, like this isn't going to work. It was a pivot out of opportunity, okay, where we saw a much bigger picture than we had seen before.
I like it. I like it. Now, I want to talk a little bit about the health and wellness aspect. Tell me about your sprinting, and tell me not just because I'm the podcast host that asked you on, but I mean, I kid you not. So Bobby Stroop, he owns a local business here in Texas called APEC, and he is Patrick Mahomes' personal agility coach. Okay. Oh, and cool. And it's been a fun story to watch too, because Bobby met Patrick when Patrick was in high school, and Bobby works with all these high school athletes. And so now his life has changed, as well as pretty much everyone in Patrick's circle, yeah, as you might imagine. And I recently, I guess it was the end of last year, I told Bobby, I was like, I want to get into master's level sprinting. I want you to train me, because I'm afraid of just leaving parts and everything on the track as I try to make it away. I'm 46. Yeah. So I know that, but I know I've still got some, at least enough fuel in the tank left to, you know, not completely embarrass myself. Tell me about your journey as it relates to being an athlete.
Yeah. Well, so, I've been an athlete in various kinds since I was 7. I started out as a diver. I became an All-American gymnast. I've done a whole bunch of stuff. I ran in high school, but then everyone got way taller than me, and that made a difference, especially because the high school track coach we had, who was our science teacher, knew nothing about coaching. So he moved me off of sprinting to long jump and pole vaulting, which I did well, but I stopped sprinting and then didn't pick it up again until 30 years later. And I had tried running in the interim a couple times. People said, let's go for a run. And I thought, sure. And I couldn't do it. It's just not my thing. And it took me until my 30s to really put two and two together and go, I'm a sprinter, not a runner. But I had nothing to do with that information. It was just something I was aware of. I've been a power athlete, basically. I lift stupid amounts of weights and do lots of power-related stuff. So one day, a friend of mine comes into brunch, and he had just won his first 5K. He'd been a runner for a long time. And I mentioned, you know, I don't run, I sprint. He goes, there's Masters Track Circuit, you know, all the Olympic events, all the track and field events for Masters athletes. Like, what? And I found a local coach, not really a good sprinting coach, but I didn't know any better at the time,
yeah,
and just jumped in. And again, constant injuries, in part because I was 45 and my brain thought I was 25.
That's me. That's right where I am, Steve. That's right where I am.
But the bigger thing is that my form was off, and I'm pushing myself. And it's not like I had been immobile, you know, in the interim. Mm-hmm. I lived in Boulder, Colorado without a car for years and rode my bike God knows how many miles a day, mostly like sprinting, basically. I can't ride for long distances. I have to push, rest for a few seconds, start again. So, because if I keep going for more than, I don't know, 10 minutes, my ATP is gone and I'm shot. And then I got to wait a few minutes for that to come back. Mm-hmm. So the form issues was probably the biggest part of it. And the thinking I was 20 years younger than I actually was is the secondary part of it. So I have no advice for you per se, because I don't know what your experience is going to be, other than to the extent that you're able to take it easy at first, I would recommend trying that, and, you know, cross your fingers. The problem is you don't know you've done too much too soon until you do much till you do too much too soon. Right. There's just no way around that. And there was actually, I got an interesting piece of advice from this one coach when I called him to complain about all my injuries. He says, how much can you deadlift? I said, I don't know. He goes, well, go test that. So I pulled about 250 pounds or so. I said, I just pulled 250. He goes, how much do you weigh? I said, about 145. He goes, call me when you're over 300. I said, wow. What? He goes, call me when you get over 300. Because what we've seen is once you get over about twice your body weight, you're strong enough that a lot of these injuries go away. Okay. And once I got over 300, that helped also. And once I got over 400, that helped also. And when I hit 400, which is a big psychological milestone, in fact, I try to lift in kilos because it's harder for me to calculate in my brain what I'm really doing. I mean, it's not rocket science, you know,
right.
times 2.2, but I don't bother doing that. But once I broke 400, my first thought was, damn it, now I got to go for five, which I knew was stupid. So I decided not to do that. But that helped also just getting stronger in with those muscles that you're using as a sprinter that you probably haven't been using as much as you might want to otherwise, which is glutes and hamstrings predominantly.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so that's why deadlifting is super helpful. Nordic hamstring curls, do you know those?
No.
Oh, so, oh man, I wish it, hold on, wait, I'm going to see if I can pull up a video. So Nordic hamstring curl, you kneel down with something holding your feet down and wait, pardon, I'm trying to make something go away so that I can find this video. So you're kneeling on a pad ideally, because otherwise you're going to crush your knees. And then you have something holding your feet down, and then you try to lower your body as slowly as you can, as far as you can. I'm going to show you a video, if I can get to it. I know other people can't see this, but it looks like this.
Okay. Yeah.
So going down as far as I just did is really, really hard.
Yeah.
And going back up the way I did is really, really hard. I couldn't do that at all way back when. In fact, I've been really working on that exercise a lot because eccentric hamstring strength is really important for running. And so that's what that's training. And so eccentric, for people who don't know, is being strong as the muscle is lengthening. So if you think about bicep curls, the down part is the eccentric part, and you're stronger eccentrically than you are concentrically on the lifting part. And there's a lot of eccentric activity in sprinting. So the Nordic hamstring curl is like a great exercise. So that's sort of my advice, if you will. And the other thing, the other big piece of advice, it took me 2 years until I realized or lived by the axiom that when I have the thought, let me do one more, that's when it's time to stop.
Yeah. So, and I... Pull back. I think I've got that. That's the thing I worry most about. That's why I went straight to a real coach that understands, because I'm not naive enough to think that I can just get out and start running as fast as I can, you know, and not hurt something. So, but while we're on that, because, you know,
let me interrupt for
a second. Yeah.
It also took me 2 years, maybe 2.5 years until I was fully comfortable going 100% all out during training.
Yeah. Yeah. And that scares the hell out of me, to be honest with you. Like whenever I do like interval training, like, and it involves like, when I don't do much interval running anymore, but when I would, it wasn't so much the taxation of it. It was just like, I'm afraid if I really push it, either I'm going to stumble, you know, or just something's going to pop.
Yeah.
So like, if you don't mind, because you are a obviously a fit guy and you get to live in that world now constantly because you get to mix it with business. So what is your protocol, both from a physical fitness standpoint, and I mean, mindfulness, breathing exercise, and then kind of what's your nutrition protocol, man? I'm always looking for tips. What do you got?
Well, look, let me take a meta view of your question. So human beings, we have this tendency to do a couple things, but here's the one I'm going to focus on. We think about something we want because we think, you know, accomplishing that or doing that or attaining that, getting that will make us happier. Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe it will, maybe it won't. Usually doesn't. We're really bad at remembering how bad we are at predicting what's going to make us happy in the future anyway. And even more, if we get the idea that there's some goal that we want to go for, we then look for other people or history to find a reliable path for getting there. And 9 times out of 10, there is no such thing. Or there may be a path, but it's so idiosyncratic, so unique to you, that it wouldn't make a difference what anybody else did. So... I'll do the business version. People say things. I've had calls like, hey, do you want to go to Richard Branson's island and hang out with him? And I go, why? They go, well, imagine what you could learn. I went, well, as far as I can tell, there's only one Richard Branson. And I don't have his personality or his money or his resources or whatever. So what am I going to learn that I could really apply tomorrow? The odds are nothing. Could be cool to hang out with him, but I'm not going to spend the money to do it.
Yeah.
So there's that component. So there's nothing that I could say most likely that would have any relevance for you at all. That said, I'll tell you some of the stuff I do.
Go for it.
So I'm on the track once or twice a week. That's it, depending on how busy I am, because we're really busy over here. Happily, we just brought on a whole new batch of employees who are very high level, who looks like are going to be able to take over a lot of the things that my wife and I have been doing for 11 and a half years. Yeah. So that'll give me some more time, so I can definitely get at least 2 days on the track. One of those days, when I was doing two a week, one of those days was like full on speed and one was more tempo work. Just to, you know, and even the tempo work, it would be like running, doing, you know, 8 by 60 meters, starting at maybe 50% of my speed, and the last four would be 90% to 100%. So even the tempo runs were still, you know, kicking it at some point. Then some time in the gym. So I've got a home gym. I'm really lazy. I don't like to, if I have to drive somewhere to work out, it ain't going to happen. I've got the equipment that I need. I've got a rack. I've got that Nordic hamstring machine that I showed a video of. I just bought a reverse hyperextension machine. It's a big glute hamstring thing that I bought in large part for anyone who's hip to lifting. Louis Simmons from Westside Barbell invented this machine after he broke his back as a way of doing glute training without straining his back. And so I, so pardon me one sec, someone just texted me an emergency message. He asked if we have
perils of being a CEO.
Yeah. Well, this is someone who works for us who lives a mile from the office, and apparently they have a power outage, and we do have power here. Anyway, so I got the reverse hyperextension machine because I have a compromised spine also, and so I wanted to be able to do more glute stuff without squatting and deadlifting as heavy as I like. And I don't like doing unilateral things. I don't like doing, you know, single leg stuff, because doing that first set, then you have to do the second set on the other leg. And if you just wasted yourself on the first one, the second one is just not fun. Again, I'm kind of lazy slash an efficiency geek. So the things that I'm doing when I'm for training is power stuff. So a lot of glute and hamstring things and plyometrics, a lot of jumping off of something and then onto something. So plyos isn't just like jumping onto a box or doing a depth jump, stepping off of a box and landing. It's the eccentric concentric thing. You step off of something, you land, you push off. So I do a bunch of that. And I was a competitive rope jumper for a while. So that's my cardio. I have a rowing machine. I like doing that too. But the jumping rope is more relevant for sprinting. So that's what I do.
I love jump rope.
And when it comes to nutrition, I'm on the, I don't know when I'm going to get hit by a bus diet.
Tell me about that. Yeah, the famous.
I don't know if you read that book. I don't have an issue with things like binging or whatever. You know, if we have some unbelievably amazing dark chocolate gelato that I made a couple months ago.
Yeah,
half of it's still in the freezer because it's so rich. I can have two spoonfuls and then I just have to put it down. And so that's sort of the way Lena and I live. Now, that said, somebody brought Krispy Kreme donuts into the office. And when I saw that, it's like, damn you. So I have no, there's certain things over which I have no willpower. Right. And that's one of them. Granted, all I did was take half of it. And if people don't know, you take a Krispy Kreme donut and you put it in a microwave for 5 seconds and it is crack. Yeah. So you can inject that shit. So I had half a donut for breakfast as well. In addition to, now what I tried, what I've been experimenting with lately, I don't like fatty foods. They don't sit well with me. Right. I don't eat meat. I eat some fish, but I don't eat meat because I have a genetic thing where I don't taste savory flavors. So meat just tastes like mushy metal to me. Mm-hmm. I've had that my whole life. So I've been experimenting with getting more protein in my diet than I normally would. Because I don't taste savory flavors, the people who have this genetic disorder, we tend to be lower in protein and higher in carbs. Now, I don't know one sprinter or power athlete who doesn't eat a bunch of carbs.
Right.
But the protein level is the one that I'm really playing with. And I don't have an answer for you about what's working for me. The protein thing has been entertaining and sometimes interesting. But frankly, I mean, right now I'm at about 146-ish, and if I really want to have the best strength to weight ratio, I'm probably going to have to be around 140. And those last 5, 6, 7 pounds, man, they're a bitch when you're 59 to get those off.
Yeah.
And what I respond to more than dietary changes is activity. And at 59, I can't recover as fast as I need to do as much activity as I need to drop those extra 7 pounds.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I'm really struggling with right now is the thing I focus most on. I try not to focus on the actual weight that's on the scale, but I do try to manage body fat percentage. And it the older you get, it's tougher. It's but one of the things that you do that I have just now incorporated back into my protocol is I am doing more resistance training. And for guys that are older like us,
must.
It is an absolute must. And I'm learning that.
Well, and here's where I have a psychological challenge, let's call it. Mm-hmm. On the one hand, I know what I need to do to do resistance training for sprinting. On the other hand, I know that losing muscle mass is a thing that happens as we start getting older. And there's some stuff that I would actually, it would be smart if I did it for hypertrophy, just to get bigger. So I've got more muscle mass as I'm getting, you know, before it just inevitably starts declining and there's nothing you can do about it. And I'm also, you know, like many people, well, at least I'm mildly vain. So I have no reason to be doing incline bench and pull-ups and things like that, but I want to impress my wife when I am naked. Yeah. So, or my friends, if we're, you know, at the beach or whatever. So right. I do some of that just because I'm vain.
Yeah.
The battle in my mind between doing a power workout for sprinting and a hypertrophy workout for either health benefits or vanity, I still wrestle with that, frankly.
Well, and I tell you what, I'm envious. So I mentioned in an email that I have a daughter at CU Boulder. She's actually here right now for a couple of weeks, but she's about to head back. And I think she's itching too. She was quick to point out to me that Boulder was voted number one city in the U.S. again for the second year straight. So at least you're surrounded by a place that it is so easy to be healthy. One of the things before I get to my next question, have you ever tried Leaf down on Pearl Street? Love it.
Their vegan chocolate cake.
Oh,
I used to go there and get that once a week. I mean, yeah. Leaf, the owner of Leaf is an old friend of mine.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh,
it's great. Yeah.
My compliments. So Abby, she's got type 1 diabetes. So she's a foodie. She was diagnosed just a few years ago.
Yeah.
So she's really tries to match to find out what's healthy. And so one night we're walking down Pearl Street and we decide, let's just try Leaf. I mean, neither of us are vegan, but we thought let's give it a shot. And tacos. Oh, my gosh. And she makes a version of those. She tried to completely rip off Leaf's recipe. As a matter of fact, we're probably going to have them tomorrow night before she heads back to Boulder. So a plug for Leaf, man. Good stuff.
Yeah, the guy who owns that place, he started out managing like a little literally hole in the wall cafe at the Naropa University in Boulder, and then had the opportunity to put a bid in to manage another restaurant in Boulder. Have you been to the Dushanbe Tea House?
No, it was recommended to me, but I've never been, but it looks so cool.
It's really fun. It's an actual tea house made in Dushanbe in Tajikistan that they took apart, brought over here, put it back together.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he won the bid for that and then just became a restaurant mogul. I don't know how many restaurants he owns now, but then also bought a farm so he could do farm to table, and really, really wonderful entrepreneurial story, and couldn't happen to a nicer guy.
Well, my compliments to him. Tell him that you, a fan of Zero Shoes, is also a fan of Leaf. Now, one of the things, as we're talking about kind of your overall health and wellness, what about mindfulness? Do you do any sort of meditation or anything like that?
So I'm laughing because prior to starting Zero Shoes, I was an internationally known meditation teacher. So I've been meditating in various ways since I was 10.
Really?
Just something I got into. Wasn't like, you know, I grew up in a cult or had a family who understood what I was doing. Let's just say that the meditative world, the mindfulness world, is massively misunderstood. And there are reasons for doing certain practices. And there are also times where the reason that you might have for doing that practice, there may be more efficacious ways of getting the results that you want. So I don't have a specific practice that I could explain in any amount of time that we have here, other than to say almost at least once a day, either in the morning, depending on when I wake up, or at night before I go to bed, I get in the hot tub. Mm-hmm. And I tend to do my wacky ass practices while I'm sitting in there. And the practices that I develop are things that they're not mindfulness per se, but they're things that you can do pretty much anytime, anywhere. It's like riding a bike. Once you learn how to do it, you can just balance. Same kind of thing. You can, the techniques that I developed aren't about trying to change what your brain is doing, trying to focus or concentrate or be aware even, because all of those are trying to manipulate what your mind is naturally doing. Instead, if you pay attention to the way your mind does the things that it does, there's ways it kind of short circuits the process. So like the world's dumbest little example, if I ask you now to pay attention to your right foot, one of the things that happened is you got an image of your right foot in your mind. Mm-hmm. You also, when I ask you to pay attention to your right foot, your attention moved in a particular direction and a particular distance. Mm-hmm. It seems, you know, you don't think your right foot is way behind you in another room.
Right.
It's down there somewhere about there. Mm-hmm. So once you know that the experience, and there's a feeling to it too, a kinesthetic thing. You're feeling sensations in your foot, which, by the way, if you look at your foot, you might notice that the sensations don't seem to match what you're seeing. Like sometimes the sensations feel like they're bigger than your actual foot, which mm-hmm. is an interesting thing mm-hmm. to notice. Mm-hmm. And if you pay attention to that image in your mind, what's it like to feel your foot without the image? Just mm-hmm. like you can't hold on to this forever, but just like for a moment, like drop the image and see what the experience is. And then drop that vector, that distance and angle thing, and see what the experience is. Mm-hmm. And then this is a really shortcut. And then do that with your whole body. Like, yeah. What if you woke up and you had never seen this thing before? What's the experience without the images and the memory? You can, once you start realizing that some of your experience is based on these, I call them qualities of thought, like memory, a kinesthetic feeling, a location, a distance, an image, you can start playing with just like setting those aside temporarily. And that can leave you in a very interesting, spacious place very effortlessly. Mm-hmm. So FYI, one of the things that I do at the beginning of 100 meters is I realize that, and I just play with this in my mind, that feeling of distance or the experience of noticing how far something is visually is a mental construct. I mean, if you only have, you know, one eye, you don't get the 3D thing.
Right.
So I, in my mind, it just flattens out the distance. So it's sort of like just looking at a 2D picture instead of a 3D thing.
Yeah.
And then I think I don't have to go very far.
That's I like that.
It's really fun to just go, I'm not going anywhere. Because strangely enough, people who don't run the 100 meters don't understand this. But at the beginning of 100, if you turn to everyone else in the race and go, God, that looks so far away, we all laugh and say, yeah. I mean, it feels like it's a forever distance away. So you just collapse the distance just for the fun of it. And there's that. And the other part, this is one, I'm a big fan of when you can get into these spacious states where your sense of subject and object is altered without you having to do anything, without you doing some active thing. And so the quietest my mind ever is consistently is at a race in that time between set and the gun going off. It's just like totally this almost effortless anticipation, empty something. And I apparently have a really good start in part because of that. And I just love that moment right before the gun goes off, just waiting.
Yeah. Wow. See, I hated it. That's why I stopped running track, is because of that moment before the gun goes off, Stephen. That's what got me out of it, man. Well,
best.
I think I would enjoy it more now, because one of the things, like on my daily scorecard, it's a whiteboard I keep. The one thing that's, I used to have a list, right, yeah, to try to check off all these things. One thing, meditate. I want to meditate every day. I think that's become kind of like the foundation. And what it means for me is consciousness, which you said, you made me feel kind of confirmed, because I am a novice, to say the least. I've probably been actually practicing mindfulness, meditation, however you want to categorize it, maybe for 2 years, seriously. And what you just said is something that it totally is not foreign to me now. It makes sense. Like Sam Harris, I do his guided meditation on the waking up, and then I've read a lot of Dawson Church's work, and this whole idea of what you said, my foot seems below me, but in consciousness, really everything is right here. And when you, oh man, and when you start to have that first time, your foot seems like this thing kind of floating out there in the ether, and yeah, it's just this thing, just like that lamp that I'm looking at over there. It's like, it's so bizarre, but it's also really cool. And then when you can slow things down to, like, for me, like having your arm still and actually moving your, like touching your fingers, and then think, then all of a sudden slowing down from your consciousness to the actual sensation of the touch.
Yeah.
It's cool, man. And it has had such a profound impact on my attitude, my interaction about different things, my thing. And you can grow the gray matter in your brain, which, who knew?
There's some debate about that. That's a whole other conversation.
Okay.
It would take way, way too long.
Okay.
Suffice it to say, when you do new things, you are laying down new neural pathways, whether you're growing gray matter or not, or keeping it. There's some debate about just how an fMRI actually does measure things and how accurate it is.
Okay.
That's a whole long story. But, you know, just another sort of meditative example for the fun of it. This is from this is a thing from a Tibetan lineage, where if you just go look at the sky, and notice that there's a thing called the sky, and there's all the stuff that appears in the sky. There's airplanes, and there's birds, and there's bugs, and there's clouds, and there's rain, and there's sun seemingly in the sky. We know it's not, but it looks like it. And then you can extrapolate that to your own mind, where if you pay attention very casually, there's sort of like a sky-like quality of your mind where things just arise in that sky-like quality. There's thoughts, and there's sensations, and there's feelings, and there's images, and there's sounds. And if you put your attention on the sky part, the thing that is, that all those other things that you experience just seem to arise and pass away in the same way clouds do and birds do and planes do, that can be very fun.
Yeah, no, I love that. I love that. It's been a game changer for me, for sure. And it's made, and so I did not know that about you also. So that's really cool. Yeah, that's cool. Well, listen, Stephen, I want to be respectful of your time. This has been so much fun. I could pick your brain for hours. Now, I will ask you this. Because you're now that your company has grown to such a degree now that, I mean, hopefully this is what you always anticipated, but I mean, it's only going to get bigger from here. Right.
Yeah, so frankly, we never imagined anything close to what we're currently experiencing.
Really? Okay.
But at the same time, it became very clear to me very early on that the potential for what we're doing is massive.
Yeah.
And more importantly, I don't think about that from a business perspective or a personal financial perspective. I mean, from the perspective of find me applications where letting your feet do what's natural doesn't make sense. They're very, very few.
Yeah.
We had a guy working for us who used to call me and go, do you know, the whole natural movement thing would work in this domain and this domain and this domain, until finally he says, do you realize the total addressable market for what we're doing is like $300 billion? And I said, yeah. So, you know, we're trying to create a movement about natural movement. We're trying to help people rediscover that natural movement is the obvious, better, healthy choice, the way we currently think of natural food. This is a very big deal. The major footwear brands know that what we're doing is legit. They've said it to the faces of people that we know. And they also know that they can't do what we're doing because it would be admitting that what they've been saying for 50 years is a lie. Mm-hmm. So we have a big mission to make this whole experience, the fun and benefits of natural movement, available to as many people as humanly possible. And it's very exciting and very challenging. And we know it's not going to be a smooth ride because the big companies are not going to take this lying down or easily or well. And we're just, that's what gets us out of bed in the morning, really, is something that my wife said. There's enough shoe companies in the world. There's no reason to have another unless your shoes change people's lives.
Yeah.
And we have tens and tens and tens of thousands of reports from people who say that that's what has happened for them. And that's what gets us out of bed in the morning, is knowing that we're doing a real thing that's beneficial for people, whether it's just for comfort or all the other benefits that they get from letting their body do what's natural.
No, I think this is a sweet spot for you, because, like, you know, Kevin Kelly's famous article about the 1,000 fans, you know, you guys have obviously thousands, and, you know, I mean, I'm not putting anything else on my feet. And again, this goes back to where I started in the Shark Tank. The thing that they couldn't account for is you and your wife and what you guys were in the past. I could see it because I've been there. I've had to give that pitch where I wanted to say, yes, but you don't understand. I'm the one that's going to execute this. You know, that's so damn hard.
I'll tell you this, though. Every entrepreneur says things like that and believes that and feels that. And that's
true.
There's a correlation between that and being successful.
Yeah.
you need that to be dumb enough to start a business. I mean, people always ask me, you know, what advice do you have for a budding entrepreneur? And I go, oh, get a government job with a pension. Like, what? I go, get a government job with a pension. If my saying that makes you contemplate it for a nanosecond, you should get a government job with a pension. And because if you're a real entrepreneur, there's nothing I could say to you that's going to talk you out of your most likely stupid idea.
Yeah.
So, and I say that because most of the ideas we come up with don't pan out for myriad reasons, some of which because it's a bad idea, often the case, some of which because there's no market now or yet, and many, many others. So, but for the sharks, they're simple. They're not looking for growth opportunities. They're looking for profit opportunities. They're looking for something where they're making money off the buy, not off the sell. If they can buy smart, they know that they're taken care of. And so, they don't care about us. They just didn't get that what we are doing is legit. And we're constantly on blog posts or articles that are the top companies that sharks were wrong about, you know, we're always on that list and they don't seem to care. That's fine. But they're, you know, they're not looking for growth. They're looking for something that's as close to a sure bet as possible. And they're of course, obviously not right 100% of the time, but whole different way of thinking. And I get it.
Well, you're the second participant that has actually gone before the sharks that have been on my podcast, and Aaron Powell of Bunch Bikes is the other, and both of you, I'm so happy that you said yes to come on and learn more about your story. You're just incredible humans, and Stephen, I thank you for this. And tell your wife, you know, Godspeed, keep going, keep pushing. I'm going to keep buying the products. Like I said, when my Prio Lunars are back in, baby, I am ordering them as soon as I can. And thank you for this time, man. You got a big company to run and you took the time for me. I'm so very grateful. I owe you dinner at Leaf.
Well, get over it, because this is fun for me, and this is my way of procrastinating. But it's also important for me to, you know, spread the word and just talk to anyone who's able to help us do that. Again, the movement part of the movement is people like you who are doing the grassroots work of just letting other people know about the benefits of what we're doing.
Well, that does it for this episode of The Jason Wright Show. Thank you so much for listening. This has been a Texas Titan Media production. Fourth Wall did the music. And as always, thank you so much for listening. Please consider going out to jasonwrightnow.com and signing up for the Vitruvian Letter. Also, please go out to iTunes. It takes like 30 seconds to just leave us a 5-star rating. It does wonders for the podcast. I would be so grateful. And with that, until we meet again, go crush it and endeavor to improve always in all ways. I'm out.